Okay, lecture number 12 and the last lecture for this class on two chapters written by Butelja, who's, I'm trying to remember her, Huria Butelja, I think. I've lost the book and I only have the copy. I lent it to my friend, whatever. You've got a documentary link or a media link where you can see her speaking. Two chapters from her book, Whites, Jews, and Us. And I'm just going to talk about each one in turn. Number one is about whiteness, right? One thing I like about Butelja's book is that she's just pulling no punches, right? She's just going vigorously at these different groups of people, including, and she thinks of herself as an indigenous woman. Specifically, she is a person of Algerian background living in Paris. And some of the links that I may have given you try to contextualize what that experience and what that population is like by looking at the history between France and Algeria. So Algeria was the first place that France colonized in Africa in 1830, and it was one of the first places to engage in a very significant independence movement post-World War II. Not the first place, but one of the first places. So she is a French Algerian woman living in France and trying to think through the power dynamics, racial dynamics, politics between her people, indigenous women, right? The second chapter is we indigenous women, and then whites. In this case, she's thinking primarily about the French, but I think everything that she has to say could apply just as much to whites in the U.S. or wherever. And then Jews. And we didn't read the thing about the Jews, but the significance of Jewish people, I suppose I'll just say this now, that I don't think I'll come back to it, but the significance just in general from her perspective is maybe two things. One, that Jews clearly historically have been a much oppressed and even exterminated minority. And so they have a lot in life which is similar to other racialized groups. And, you know, like Chicanos and like black folks in the U.S. And like Arabs, especially in the last 20, 30 years in the U.S. but because Jewish people are not as, depending on, you know, where they're coming from, are not necessarily so obvious, they have also been able to pass within white society a lot. So when she talks about the Jewish population in Europe, this is one of the primary things she's thinking about. There are plenty of affluent Jewish people, like, seriously involved in the economic, social structure of Europe as it now exists. And then she's also thinking very specifically about the Middle East and about Israel. She identifies with the Palestinians against the Israelis in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And her criticism there is one that I would have as well, that the Israelis are firmly lined up with Western powers to the extent that Israel probably has to be understood as a sort of outpost of industrial capitalist Western NATO a power in the Middle East. And so she's attacking white folks. Or rather, she wants to critically analyze whiteness, and she wants to specifically attack the white left, who she thinks think that they always think. This is the thing about whiteness. We always think that we're acting in everybody's benefit when, in fact, we're really only acting in our own. And the reason that we're able to make this mistake is that we really can't see that there is any perspective besides ours. This is, you know, part of her critique of whiteness. She's an interesting writer because she's writing from this French Arab perspective, but she's reading a whole lot of black liberation thought. So when she says these things, it's her thought, but it's also very tightly connected to people like, say, James Baldwin and Angela Davis. Okay, so much for the Jews because I didn't give you that writing, but whites and us, right? So we have two problematics here. One is that she's attempting to analyze what constitutes whiteness, and she makes a very interesting claim about whiteness, which, again, I didn't give you James Baldwin in this class. I use him in my other classes. But it really reminds me of James Baldwin because it gives people like me, I'm some middle-aged white dude, look very white, and yet I'm not comfortable with this racial position, and I'm not comfortable with the ignorance that goes along with it, and I would like to do something different. I don't really want to be white in all of these nasty senses. Well, she says something very much like James Baldwin does, along the lines that, well, what she says is, whiteness is, deliberate, meaning that it's something that is freely chosen and therefore that could be chosen against, right? I find this very interesting. So I'm going to go through her, you know, what we said about whiteness before and then through her analysis of whiteness. And I am going to take a pause and talk through all this stuff that she says about René Descartes, even though, and then maybe just because, you know, I'm a philosophy person. Like, I'd studied philosophy, and so I know something about Descartes, but I think it's some interesting stuff. And then I'm going to go on and talk about the second problematic, which is the idea that indigenous women, and specifically Arab women, and even more specifically Muslim women, in the global north, particularly in Paris, and in France, that they live in a patriarchal society, which, depending on who you're talking about and where, sometimes requires women to be veiled. We're going to talk through the problem here, where the white left wants to convince indigenous women, we indigenous women, wants to convince young Muslim women in France, for example, that they ought to get liberated and lose the hijab and lose the burqa, and that the white left can liberate them in this respect. And she has a militant attitude towards this, which is that it is not white liberals who need to decide what indigenous women do. And she wants to make a very specific claim, which is that, okay, yeah, so there are patriarchy issues within subjected populations of women, but these patriarchal issues, have to be worked out by those women, and they need to make an evaluation. They need to recognize that while, yes, they are dominated to varying degrees internally by men and by the history of patriarchal culture, which in this case points back to the imposition of Islamic society upon, say, Northern Africa, while this is true, that we have to understand this domination to be nested within a larger system of domination, which is the domination of all indigenous peoples, all globally southern peoples, by northern peoples and by capitalism, etc. in general. And she wants to say, no, we got to start with loyalty to our own people and opposition to this system and to the supremacy of the white north, and only after that, and only within our own communities, should we figure out exactly how we can overcome patriarchy. Okay, so let's go back to whiteness. Let's remember what it is that we have said about whiteness before. So whiteness, like blackness, like womanness, is not an ahistorical category. Ahistorical means without history. These categories have a history. It's not just that there have always been some people in the world who have pale skin and then they have cultural similarities with one another because they're all hanging out in the snow in Northern Europe or something like that. No, whiteness didn't exist up until the middle 1600s to middle 1700s. That category was not used by anybody. And it showed up especially, and I think first, in the United States, as it became tactically necessary for a slave-owning capitalist elite to build a defense against two primary sources of anxiety, namely the enslaved African-American population and the genocided or being in the process of genocided native populations. So, you know, in the 13, 1400s, as Cedric Robinson told us at the beginning of this course, Europeans did not understand themselves as being all white. There were profound degrees of racialization within the populations of European nations. And especially those nations built themselves upon differences. They imported immigrants, which they then enslaved and which they racialized in order to explain those people being in lower positions. So Bulgarians and Slavs and Irish historically occupied lower positions within European racialized hierarchical orders. Same thing is true in the 1600s as immigrants are coming to the Eastern Seaboard to occupy the English colonies in North America. The Irish and the English did not think of themselves as the same kind of people. There was no category called white which unified them. And if you look at some of the writing from that period about Irish people, this is the kind of thing that shows up in Robinson's book, you'll see that the same things are said about the Irish as would later be said about Negroes, or as would be said about Chicanos, or as would be said about women. That these people are more passive, they're lazier, they're not very self-determining, they lack a certain amount of reason that the upper classes have. You see, the racialization is always kind of the same. Whiteness as such, as an idea that even lower class people have something in common with upper class people insofar as they are of a European background. You know, this kind of crap that drives contemporary neo-Nazism and fascism in the U.S. That idea shows up and is generally distributed as a part of a fairly thought out campaign to unify poor white folks with their bosses and to form a front which could oppose the threats coming on the one hand from the African-American population and on the other hand from the Native American population. And both of these populations really were threats. I mean, that's an important thing to recognize. It's not just that like there were some worries going on here. Like any enslaved population is a population which will threaten to rise up. And there were slave rebellions all through the history of slavery. And there were all kinds of rebellions on the part of Native American people too. Okay, so that's what we know about whiteness coming in here. Now we've got an analysis of what she calls the central features of whiteness. So, okay, what is it that, like, in being constructed as a white man, so I'll take myself as an example here because I don't have to worry about offending myself, right? And I just want to tell you, like, I recognize my own experience when she writes. I think she's got it kind of right. And I appreciate that she wants to tell me that it's deliberate and that I can do something different. And also, I'll tell you this too. I just finished teaching this class and we just did this class just a few weeks ago in a real room with real people who I really got to know and who really got to know one another because they had a real class. You're paying the same amount of money for a class where you never meet anybody, don't form any community, don't have any honest discussion with other people. That sucks. Anyway, because I knew the people in this room and we had a very good open community where we discussed with one another, a lot of people pointed out to me, and I think it's true, that the things that are said here by Buttigieg about whiteness, in a lot of ways, they're true about Americanness. You know, so it's not only white folks who can be, I don't know, systematically and structurally wrong in the ways that she describes here. I think there are a whole lot of Americans who are people of color, but who still engage in or see the world in the way that Buttigieg describes as white. And those people are a problem as much as the white folks are. And the mistakes that they're making, I suppose, would be deliberate as much as the mistakes that the white people are making, and therefore they could change their ways too. So maybe what we're talking about here is not just whiteness, but, you know, a general form of narcissism and willful ignorance, which characterizes a bunch of the global north and extends beyond whiteness. But we'll see. You know, you can tell me what you think about that. Is that true or not? Okay, so number one, centrality or narcissism. The idea that everything is based around the individual and that I, as the white man, okay, I'm the center of evaluations. I know what's happening. What I know is what is real. What is happening in relationship with me. This is a feature of whiteness. I don't think of myself as being secondary. I don't think of myself as being somebody else's tool. And if I do, you know, and I start to analyze my class position, I certainly am somebody's tool. I'm the tool of this institution. I'm the tool of the deans. You know, I'm just doing some like grunt work in order to like, you know, bring you, your tuition money in. But when I think about that, it wounds my narcissism. And so like there's something about whiteness that, that doesn't want to talk about that stuff, that doesn't want to recognize its own powerlessness. Now, this idea of the I and of my consciousness being totally intact and totally right, the one that really knows, this is connected to the technical things that she wants to say about Descartes. So I'll save that and come back to it in a bit. Maybe the most important thing she wants to point out, though, the most important feature of whiteness is innocence. White people feel like it's not their fault. And it's these two things. It's not my fault, and I can't do anything about it. Now, this is what white folks will generally say to you, and this is probably what Americans will generally say to you, when you point out that white people benefit from a racialized system which historically has kept minority groups, which is a rough term because it's not true in most places, it's not true in Los Angeles, racialized groups, has kept certain groups, oppressed groups, in lower positions and made it such that white people have way more privilege, more likely to go to good schools, more likely to get a good paying job, more likely to find themselves in a professional position. If you talk to a white person and you're like, hey, you know, part of the reason you're there is just because you're white, man. They'll be like, no. Nah. Well, first they want to believe that everything comes from their own, will and decision making. But then if you point out like, hey, look, you know, like there's this economically unequal history that leads us to the present, the answer is going to be like, well, that's not my fault. You know, I didn't do it. I didn't do slavery. That was a long time ago. It's not my fault. And, you know, if there are still kind of inequalities around, well, I can't do anything about it. Is there still racism around? Yeah, but I can't do anything about it. Is there structural racism? Are institutions set up so that they continue to operate differently upon populations of color and populations of white folks? Yeah, but you know, I can't do anything about it. It's not my fault. I didn't set it up. I'm not like trying to get over on anybody here, and I can't do anything about it. So she wants to trace this to like, you know, this is the way that colonizers have always talked. They always speak as if they are innocent, and that really, if you want to find somebody guilty, it's going to be the colonized. She says it's the same thing as like, cowboys in the movies were always the good guys and in the books are always the good guys because the whites are controlling the media production, right? And the Indians are always the bad guys. And she says, you know, this is really simple. You want to understand why and how white folks across history have been able to identify themselves as innocent? It's just because they controlled the means of enunciation. They controlled the means of the production and distribution of ideas. Because they had the power to do so, they declared themselves to be angels. But underneath this innocence, there is another feature, fear. White people know at some level that they are not innocent. They know that they benefit from a system which is exploitative, a system which is racially unequal, a system which does privilege them over others, and a system globally which could not exist were it not for the mass exploitation of third world labor, third world countries, third world resources, the general global south, which is subjected to dictatorial regimes, pollution, and all the rest. White folks, and here we might broaden out and say Americans, actually do know that that's what's going on. You know, consciously, they want to pretend it's not the case. They'll always act as if they're totally innocent, but they really don't want this conversation at all because deep down, they know that they are where they are and that they have what they have only because others are hurt and killed and raped and dying. We know that's going on, but we can't admit it. We don't want to admit it because admitting it would mean, okay, I have to accept my guilt. I have to accept that much of what I have, maybe I shouldn't have. Does that mean I have to give it up? And so this leads to what she takes to be, what she says is the central dilemma for white people, which is that we're afraid and we are holding on to our comfort. So we have to stay afraid because in order to change anything, we would have to give up our comfort, but we don't want to give up our comfort. And here's another place where I think we could just as well be talking about North Americans, people in the U.S., on a broader scale with respect to the rest of the world. Okay, but whiteness is deliberate, and we could stop doing it. Let's see, should I talk about the cogito and all that? I guess I will just briefly. I was going to talk about it more at length, but now that I look at the notes, how important is it? Okay, she talks about Descartes and the cogito. The cogito, that's a Latin term, and it means I think, right? Probably the most famous moment of Western philosophy, and you will have heard of it, is the declaration, I think, therefore I am. That's René Descartes, a French thinker in Amsterdam at that point in 1640, writing in order to try to establish what he takes to be the foundation for possible sciences. I guess I am going to talk about this. I think it does fit in here. She wants to say that what shows up with that particular writer is a sort of diagram of what white consciousness is like from that point forward. You know, what does the white mind think of itself? And I think this one is particularly applicable to the white professor. It's applicable to me. This shit describes me, and it describes my position. And you know, from my perspective, I can tell you, yeah, I think this is like what my position established in me. Now, I might be somewhat unique in that, like, you know, I've had cause and I have gone through and sort of rethought a whole bunch of this shit. But I know that this is how the position works for me. Being a white professor, this is how it works for me. Maybe it requires for me to be an adjunct for 20 years, you know, to be like belittled and exploited for 20 years in order for me to like overcome the illusions that were handed to me as a present. Anyway, so first question is like, okay, so... And I used to teach philosophy a lot. I still teach philosophy. Now I'm back into a philosophy department. And I used to always teach the history of philosophy just internally. Like, let's just look at, we'll look at, you know, Plato, and then we'll look at Aristotle, and then we'll look at the Middle Ages, and then we'll look at early moderns like Descartes, and then we're going to look at later moderns, and then we're going to look at I would always teach this history as if it had no outside, as if Western thought was just thinking. And it wasn't determined by historical circumstances. I can't do that anymore. And she asks this question. She's like, can you separate, how does she put it? I don't see it here in my notes. But she says something like, can you separate what this French white philosopher in Amsterdam in 1640 is saying from the context of its enunciation? That means the place where he said it. And her answer is just no. So, like, what Descartes has to say here is not separable from the fact that he is a white guy in Amsterdam, which is the center of the world capitalist economy at that point in time. So we're getting an announcement of how domineering and dominant consciousness is going to understand itself within the system. And domineering and dominant consciousness is going to be specifically white, even if whiteness as a concept hasn't been fully delineated at this point in time. Certainly the hierarchy of men over women is getting put well in place by this time, and the hierarchy of certain European land-owning, capital-owning classes over racialized groups, that's already in place. Okay, so what is it that Descartes thinks he's doing? He's attempting, this is a famous, this is one of the most famous philosophical texts in Western history. It's called Descartes' Meditations on First Philosophy. And what he's attempting to do is to establish what is the foundation for scientific knowledge. How do we know that science, which means knowledge, really is knowledge? And this is an understandable sort of thing because at this point in time, you know, if you went back 200 years before Descartes, the view that European intellectuals had about the world was radically different than what they were thinking by 1640. Go back to 1440, and you still have a world which is based in Christian theology, a worldview which is based in Christian theology. But if you get up to 1640, now we're moving towards modern science. And so all these old ideas had been thrown out, and they had been recategorized as, well, they were really just opinion and mythology. And so Descartes' question about science was, how do we know that science is really science? What's the foundation for all knowledge? And here the answer that he eventually gives is the foundation of all knowledge is the mind's awareness of itself. I can doubt everything else. I can doubt that I'm really talking to you right now because I've had plenty of dreams as a professor in which I was like lecturing some shit and blah, 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 and now I wake up like, oh, wow, that was a dream. Okay, so this could be a dream. But even if it's a dream, insofar as I am thinking, I know that I exist. So what this amounts to is, and it gets developed in the history of Western philosophy, especially with, say, like Hegel in the early 1800s, is a doctrine which suggests that that the mind is a self-contained sort of thing. That consciousness is not just conscious, not just awareness of things out there, but also awareness of self. That the mind is self-grounding. So there's this feeling of certainty about my thought and my understanding as a foundation for everything else. Now, I think when she says that this basic idea cannot be separated from the context of its enunciation, what she's saying is that Descartes isn't just speaking for himself, and he's not just answering a technical epistemological question. Episteme also means knowledge. Logos about episteme. Epistemology would mean discourse about knowledge and what makes knowledge. So he's answering an epistemological question, but he's not just doing that. What he's actually doing is announcing something like the white experience, the masterly experience, the male experience, the patriarchal experience of thought and of subjectivity. What's it like to be a white dude in a system that is organized around the power of white dudes, or to be a white knowing dude, or to be a white upper class knowing dude within such a system? It is to feel that you are totally secure. I know stuff. I just know stuff. And, you know, so like I said, you know, I think this applies to professors a lot. You know, we show up in class and we just know things and we speak in a just knowing way. And, you know, a whole lot of you have been trained to respond to that kind of knowing voice with passivity and obedience. Like, oh, wow, look, there's some white dude. He knows what he's talking about. And of course, people who are, you know, women and people of color, they can occupy that position. And maybe, depending on their experience, they can even come to experience that kind of self-certainty. But nevertheless, it's a feature of the system, and it's not true. We are not actually in charge of our own minds. Our consciousness is not perfect self-consciousness. I don't understand my own thought. I don't know everything. I don't really know. I really don't have certainty. So the basic point is that like Descartes describes the subject position of dominant consciousness within the system, and that form of consciousness which thinks that it knows everything, which thinks that the way it talks is the way that knowledge is expressed, which thinks that knowledge and therefore authority and the ability to make decisions is centered in itself. And it doesn't need to ask anything else. It is empowered. It is self-affirming. This is the white voice. This is white consciousness. She says, you know, the cogito is ultimately, what does she call it, a dogmatic or colonial norm. But it's also ultimately an armed predator, because what it says is like, I know, I command, I own, I control. That is the voice of white, rich patriarchy. So there's your race, class, gender, right? This is dominant race, class, and gender speaking. So then I look at this and I'm like, whoa, fuck, there are lots of ways in which I have acted like that. I have felt like that as a white man who knows. Now, I don't come from an upper class background. I come from working class background. And I don't come from, well, whatever. There are a few little glitches that let me see what that was. But, you know, I'm still guilty of it in a whole bunch of different ways. And probably even a bunch of you who are, you know, not identifying as white folks may well have that sort of attitude in different ways. And so then the question is like, okay, if Buttigieg is right that this is deliberate, that it could be otherwise, that we could change our minds. So what would we have to do then? Well, I think it's that I have to begin by acknowledging my ignorance. I have to stop acting like I'm so certain of myself and that I'm certain of everything else and that I have the language and I have the manner of approach that allows me to really know shit, whereas other folks coming from different angles of attack, they only think they know shit. They only have opinions. I have knowledge. You know, I gotta drop that arrogance right there. White people need to be less arrogant. Men need to be less arrogant. Rich folks need to be less arrogant. Educated folks need to be less arrogant. Okay, let's start there. But we also have to be willing to acknowledge the injustices in which we are involved. And this is here's where we're not just talking about whiteness, we're talking about Americanness. You know, like people in the United States do not like to acknowledge there could be no such thing as the affluent United States. And even that is a bit of an overstatement. Take my other classes if you want to think about this stuff. But we could not live as we live were it not for production in Indonesia and Vietnam and Thailand. If there weren't the global South whose resources have been robbed from it from the beginning of this era, from 1500 on, then there would be no global North either. Were it not for Africa, there could be no Europe. You know, Europe with its high-speed trains and its skyscrapers and its financial hubs and its all that could not exist without systematic injustice in taking everything from the South. So a foundational moment for stopping performing this whiteness or stopping performing this Americanness is to be able to recognize the injustice in which you're involved. That we're involved in injustice in a whole bunch of ways. And we have to acknowledge this shit before we know exactly how to stop it. So that means we have to accept our guilt, not just get submerged by it and feel really bad and engage in, like, you know, behaviors to, like, get away from it, but just recognize that it's there and start talking honestly about how we're going to fix it. And this also means that we have to be willing to forego our privilege. There's all kinds of privileges that white folks have, white men have, affluent white men have, but some of those privileges are also had by people of color. There's all kinds of Asian and Black and Mexican and people with Mexican ancestry who are in controlling positions within corporations. They have now that privilege, and what's going to be offered to them is also this sense of like, hey man, I didn't do it. It's not my fault. I can't fix it. That whiteness thing, or that, well, you know, I am where I am because I know shit and I think about shit right. So you can't tell me I don't understand what's going on. You can't tell me anything because I'm, well, white, American, the boss. People have to drop that shit and they have to be willing to do away with that solace and that pleasure. And then specifically what Buttigieg just says is, We need to break our solidarity and break our identification with our states. Because, you know, when we talk about American military intervention in Mexico and South America and European intervention across Africa and, you know, the war on terror involving intervention all through the Middle East and Central Asia, we say we, but I'm not doing it. And, you know, even if you have been in the service, well, you didn't make those decisions, right? And people who go into the service typically go into the service because they come from lower class backgrounds, and they perceive either rightly or wrongly that their path to success, which is some bullshit that we are all sold all the time, could only be had by joining the service. And they certainly didn't decide where they were going to go to war. So we need to stop saying we when we talk about our country, when we talk about our military, when we talk about our state apparatuses and their bureaucracies. That's the real thing we need to do. If you check out the interview with Boutelja, she's asked, you know, like, what can like white leftists or feminists or people in the global north, what can they do? They can fight imperialism at home, is what she says. You got to fight against the capitalist state structure which you now occupy. You have to actively be engaged in trying to change the structure, or else you're just being white. Okay, now, because I don't want to make this too long a recording, let me go on to the second chapter, which I learned from my class that people find way more problematic. And I'll just basically reiterate it and reiterate what her position is. She, by the way, if you find this an interesting topic, this chapter in which she talks about the veil and the fact that French society in particular has identified the veil as something that profoundly problematic about Arabic and Muslim society, if you really want to like understand this whole thing, I'm pretty sure you can find this on the internet for free. Look up an essay written by Frantz Fanon called Algeria Unveiled. Now, that's written in, I'm guessing here, I'm going to say like 1960 or so. And it's written, I'll tell you about that essay, because I think it really sets up where Boutelja is at. Boutelja's reading like North American black radicals and Frantz Fanon. That's almost entirely where, as far as I can tell from this book, where she's coming from. Okay, so in Algeria Unveiled, Frantz Fanon, black guy from Martinique, grew up French speaking. I told you about him a little bit. He ended up being posted as a psychiatrist in colonial Algeria. And so he was there as the Algerian independence movement started, as the war started. And in the midst of that war, there was a conscious, so this is the French colonial forces fighting, you know, together with the Pied Noir, who are the colonial population in Algeria, a commanding European-based minority, against the general population, which is part Arabic, part Berber, indigenous population, in opposition to a colonial population. So this is an anti-colonial war. And in the midst of this war, the French are having a hard time. This is one of those demonstrations, Vietnam being the other really important one. And then Cuba, I suppose, showing that guerrilla warfare makes it possible for weakened but popular resistance organizations to fight much more heavily armed colonial forces. So the French discover that, whoa, shit, like we can't just like bomb them all to hell. It doesn't work. They keep fighting. What are we going to do? And they come up with this very specific plan to target the women, in Algeria. And they figure if they can break the women, or if they can pull the women over to their side, that they can crumble the entirety of the community. Now, this is really central to what Boutelja is concerned with, this idea that a colonial power or a dominating power or a capitalist power, and they all empirically go together historically, that it has the explicit and conscious goal of breaking the community, breaking the solidarity between people, the sharing, the sense of being a we. It wants to break that in the populations that it needs to control. In a lot of ways, this whole class has been about this process, right? When the Europeans show up in North America, they insist that native populations become patriarchal, right? They introduce division. They break community. Colonization and the expansion of capitalist relations has to do with the breaking of community at every front. They had to break the community of women. They had to break the community of peasants in Europe. They had to break the community of women and break the community in the New World. This happened all over the place. And it happens very specifically in Algeria around 1960. And the way that the French go about this is that they fixate on the veil. And Fanon's like, you know, just because it's like an obvious feature of this culture, you can identify modes of dress very easily and say, like, okay, that's the culture. And they choose the veil. And with the veil, they then go talk to women and they say, hey, look, your men, they're dominating you. They're making you wear that veil. They're hiding you. They're like, you're their property or some shit. Like, let us help liberate you. You just take off that veil, and we're going to make sure that you have equal status within our society. Now, the purpose of this campaign is actually to break apart the Algerian family and the Algerian community so that the women are going to defect, and the strength of the resistance of the Algerian people against the French is going to be broken. Now, Fanon goes on at length about like how this plays out in time, and even gets around to talking about how there can be still critically conscious and non-religious Algerian women or Muslim women who intentionally wear the veil now as a sign of resistance to European culture, and not so much because they are committed to Islamic ways of life or to their subjection as women to men within that society. Okay, so this is where Boutelja is coming from. She's like, the same thing happened to her growing up in France, and it happened in various ways. One way is that there were movies, you know, so there's mass distribution of media which represents to certain populations how they should live. And so the one that she talks about is this film called Pierre and Jamila, or Jamala, Jamila, and it represents a French Arab woman falling in love with a white Frenchman. And in that movie, the Arabic or the Muslim woman's family end up being all backwards and problematic. And the white prince is going to save her from these tribal relationships within the Algerian community in France. She's like, okay, this is what's happening in general. When French liberals point at Arabic women in French society and they say, hey, look, you have to wear that veil. Your society's messed up and backwards. You know, we French, we're egalitarian. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. You know, we're all about equality. And in our society, you know, women can be in charge of everything. They don't have to wear veils. Let us liberate you from your backwards brothers and fathers. And she's like, okay, now that's tempting, right? Because patriarchy within the Muslim community in France is real. You know, she talks about she has a tattoo on her thigh, which represents her belonging to a particular portion of her community. She's owned by that community. She's like, so it's, you know, it's alluring. And not to mention that the whole media apparatus backs all this stuff up. She's like, and a whole bunch of us French Arab women, we fall for it, or we start to fall for it. And a lot of people, and the result is that women defect from their families and from their communities, and those communities, which could be real bases of resistance to the expansive capitalist system, those are broken too. She's like, but that's what we have to understand. We have to understand that the attack is an attack on the community. It's not intended ultimately to liberate women. It's intended to break Muslim resistance to capitalist modernization. And you know, one of the varieties of proof is, well, look, it's not like sexism is completely absent from French society. In fact, French society is radically sexist. And she gives a couple of examples. You know, one is that there were 40,000 plus rapes just in the year that she's writing this text, which is what, 2016, 2017. Tremendous number of rapes across France. There's pornography all across France. There's radical objectification of women. There's, you know, sale of images of women for commodifying purposes. It's not like women's integrity and dignity and personhood is systematically defended in French culture. Not at all. She's like, you know, even there's this woman, I don't know if you know her, but her name is Simone de Beauvoir. I could have included her in a class like this. I wanted a more international perspective, but she's a famous French white feminist. When Simone de Beauvoir died in France, they circulated images of her, or I guess on the anniversary of her death, they circulated images of her naked. So here's this French feminist who historically argued against the objectification of women being honored by an image of her objectified as a woman, as a commodity, as something to be viewed and enjoyed sexually by men. She's being circulated in that way. It's not that France is opposed systematically to sexism or opposed to patriarchy. No, no, no. It's being selective, and it's choosing the indigenous community and saying, hey, look, we want to defend your honor. Why don't you break ranks with your brothers and your husbands and your fathers so that we can save you? She's like, we have to see this attack for what it is. It's the same thing as it was in a war condition in Algeria. They're still trying to break our community. And if we understand what's really happening here, we will then understand who are our people really. And even if our people, and here we could generalize this, right? We could talk about Gloria Anzaldúa, et cetera. Even if amongst our people, whoever that is, there are still problems of domination, we have to work out those problems of domination within our community and not let the community be broken to begin with. Because if we let the community, say, of Arabs in France or of Muslim women in Paris, if we allow that community to be broken, first of all, there will be no hope for fighting the system at all. I'll give you one more example, which she mentions and which we saw one other time, too, in our reading. I can't remember off the top of my head right now where. But there's one more example of this, which is particularly glaring. I had a student years back, smart guy, white guy, who was in graduate school for art where I was teaching, but who had been a lieutenant in the Marines and had served in Afghanistan. And I remember talking with him and saying, you know, you don't really strike me as the kind of guy who, like, would have just up and joined the Marines. And he didn't have to do this for the kind of economic reasons that a lot of people do. I was like, why did you do it? And he said, you know, I went there to defend women. I went there to save women. And I realized, you know, that was a really big part of the salesmanship that went around the Afghanistan conflict, right? This was in the news a lot. Like, there's a if you go on YouTube, I might have put this link up for you already, but check out Laura Bush talking about women in Afghanistan, the wife of George Bush. There was this claim made that not only was the United States going into Afghanistan in order to attack terrorist cells who had dared to attack the U.S., and of course there's something profoundly white and American about that narrative too, because it hides the way in which Pakistan, the ISI, and the CIA together constructed both the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda within Afghanistan as a part of a general scheme to push against the Russians. It ignores all that shit about how the terrorists were manufactured by, you know, the intelligence services of the global north. They just ignore that shit. And it's like, hey, there's some like crazy, you know, like Muslim people who are extremists and they're attacking us, so we have to go attack them in Afghanistan. So there was that rationale, which was profoundly duplicitous. But then there was another one which played on this exact formula that Buttigieg is talking about, which said, hey, look how the Taliban treats their women in Afghanistan. They're turned into objects. They're owned as chattel. They're put into these burqas. They're not even allowed to be seen in public. They need to be saved from their own men. Colonized women need to be saved from their own men. Racialized women need to be saved from their own men. And this is something that you can get white guys to do. So why, what is the rationale that this Marine has going into Afghanistan as he objectively becomes an occupying force in a foreign country? And his job, by the way, I talked to him at length, his job was to lead a team to within sight of a potential target and then to get an exact GPS reading on that target and then call in an airstrike. So he's a guy responsible for bringing bombs down on the heads of people he never met. He's a deliverer of violence and death. Why does he feel okay doing this? Or why did he feel okay until he started to think better of it? Because allegedly, he's saving women by doing this. So there's an appeal to this macho sense of self-worth, which has to do with, I am the protector of women. My value lies in and the passivity of women who need to be saved by me. There's a utilization of this patriarchal, hierarchical relationship, fantastic relationship. You know, I mean, exists in fantasy and like how we fantasize ourselves between white men or between men and women, which is used in order to fuel the actual aggressive, violent behavior of white men towards whole populations, including women and children. Okay. So the answer that Buttigieg gives is like, okay, yeah, shit is complicated. Yeah, there is patriarchy within racialized and colonized populations. But if we let white liberal thought guide us, you know, these liberals and these leftists who claim that they're trying to change the system, they know what's better for everybody, really what they're doing is serving the system too. And so what really needs to happen is that oppressed communities need to form tighter and tighter community. They need to draw back together. And instead of being lured off into corporate structure, instead of being lured off into the ways of life of the larger scale society which has incorporated them, they need instead to draw back to reinforce the bonds that connect them with other people in their situation, and then to work out their problems internally. But form a base which is capable of resisting that large-scale machine. And then I would offer the large-scale strategy here is that group of Arab women, Muslim women in Paris can then form alliances with, say, black women in the United States in the same way that Buttigieg is using the black radical tradition in order to understand her own situation. They can form, you can have autonomous groups which form into confederate relations with one another. And this might form the basis for an opposition that could push back this system globally. And I suppose, you know, at some level, it's not too bad if you have some defecting whites like me, you know, on your side. But you shouldn't trust me to lead anything because, well, I'm fucking white.